Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The Jewish Confederate, the life and times of Judah P. Benjamin, this week on Soundings. My guest is Eli Evans, president of the Charles Revson Foundation. Eli Evans is the author of Judah P. Benjamin, The Jewish Confederate, published in paperback last September by the Free Press. According to Eli Evans, Judah P. Benjamin was a pioneer, the first Jew elected to the United States Senate, cabinet officer during the Civil War, and accomplished international attorney. Here is Eli Evans.
Benjamin really is a part of my history experience for me. You know, this is really, while it's a biography of Judah P. Benjamin, it's also the story of Jews in America and the American South in the 19th century and their great adjustment and assimilation into the American culture. Mm-hmm. Judah P. Benjamin is important, it seemed to me, and it seemed he deserved a new look because he was a real breakthrough personality for America. He was the first acknowledged Jew elected to the U.S. Senate. He certainly was the first Jew to break into the councils of national power and to become a national figure. He was the kind of breakthrough personality that enabled other minorities to run for office in this country. And in that sense, he was the most emancipated Jew of his era. You know, for the Jews in this country, the emancipation from the ghetto after the French Revolution in Europe and the American Revolution here was as great a shock as the 2,000 years of being in the ghetto had been. Suddenly they were free. They were free to dream and to participate and to be a part of the great American unfolding frontier and community.
Well, let's talk about the man himself, Eli Evans. Stephen Vincent Benet calls him the Dark Prince of the Confederacy. Talk to me for a moment about stereotypes. Talk to me about what you went through as a biographer, peeling away the layers of this onion to get to the man himself.
Well, I think the most first important thing that I can say is that clearly I was the right biographer for Judah P. Benjamin. There was a search for Judah P. Benjamin, but in a sense we found each other. And I must say I learned an awful lot about myself in working and writing on this book. I say that because I was a son of the South. I was born in the South. I was raised in its politics. I had written and researched Jews in the South for many years. It had been my first book. My father had run for office. I'd participated in Southern politics. I'd worked for a while for Governor Terry Sanford in this state. And therefore, I think I was drawn to him in a way because there were shadows of myself, reflections of myself, and my own history in him. I was the right biographer, and while I found Benjamin, I think we found each other. And in that sense, I knew very early when I was writing this that I was not only writing the story of Judah Benjamin, and I'm really getting back to the question you ask, but also the story of all Jews who had been in the South in this very difficult period in American history. It has been called the most anti-Semitic period in history. Benjamin was the lightning rod for that prejudice as its most visible Jewish figure. And therefore, he stands, I think, in the place of, as a part of, as a prototypical, paradigmatic figure, a Jewish figure in Southern history.
Let me stop you for a moment, Eli. You say, nevertheless, that that Judah P. Benjamin had to wrestle with his Jewishness, that it was an ambiguous and a difficult issue for him to be a Jew, to express his Jewishness. Tell me about that. Tell it to me in terms of his political career and the social life that he led in the South.
Well, Benjamin was like so many of the Sephardic Jews who were the first wave of Jews to come to this country. You know, it's not widely known that there were more Jews in Charleston, South Carolina in 1800 than in any other city in America.
Goodness.
It is not widely known that the Jewish community in the South was larger than the Jewish community in the north in the early part of the 19th century, only because it wasn't until thermal navigation opened up the northern ports that Jews from Europe came there. This first wave of Jews who came in the 1700s and early 1800s, and Benjamin was a part of it, the Sephardic wave that came out of Spain, went to England, and then came to America, had to reinvent themselves on the American frontier. They were suddenly cast into this new country. And the adjustment for that cluster of Jews, I think, was a very difficult one. I remember in my research on Jews in the South finding communities that when the Jewish community, Jews first came there, they didn't want to build a synagogue. And then in the fundamentalist South, they found that everyone was expected to belong to a church, and lo and behold, they built a synagogue and began a congregation.
As John Shelton Reed would say, which church do you go to?
Right, what church do you go to? And they had to answer that question.
Right.
I contend that Benjamin could only have happened in Louisiana, in the sense that Louisiana was a largely Catholic state in a largely fundamentalist South. New Orleans quadrupled in growth from between 1830 and 1850. It was shorn from its traditional power roots. Mm-hmm. Benjamin was a, let's face it, a brilliant lawyer. I mean, here was a man who not only was elected to the U.S. Senate, but was offered a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, and would have been the first Jew on the court had he accepted 60 years before Louis Brandeis. He turned it down because he wanted to go to the Senate, and he wanted to be a U.S. Senator. Here was a man who not only was elected to the U.S. Senate, but then emerged as first Attorney General, then Secretary of State, I mean, then Secretary of War, mm-hmm. and ultimately Secretary of State to the Confederacy. He was called the brains of the Confederacy. He has been called the American Disraeli, the Confederate Kissinger. He's just quite a figure, and here was a man who had everything, power, fame, wealth, and lost it all at the end of the Civil War, and then regained it again in England after the war.
Are there ways, Eli Evans, in which Benjamin's Jewishness bears directly on his role in the Civil War? Is that external to the politics of what happened in the Civil War in the United States?
It is my contention that they were forged in this friendship between Jefferson Davis and Judah P. Benjamin, a very rare partnership. Many people and reviewers have noted that the book is as much a biography of Jefferson Davis for its insights into Davis as it is of Judah P. Benjamin.
Yeah, you spend a good bit of time talking about him.
I think that Davis, you know, we in this country, it took until the 1920s for us to recover as historians from the war and begin to look at Lee and Jackson and the great generals as Americans, and to absorb the Civil War as part of the American experience and as the figures in it as legitimate American heroes. Mm-hmm. We have yet to come to grips with the political figures for complex reasons. And I think Davis is one of those people that has really suffered from not having the kind of, although there have been 8 biographies written about him, there are certain insights about him that are just missing.
Well, tell me about his collaboration with Judah Benjamin.
Well, the point to this is that that Davis was taken from, sent from Mississippi at the age of 8. Imagine that, 1,000 miles to an all-Catholic school. He was a fundamentalist Baptist. To an all-Catholic school in Kentucky. He was the only Protestant in this school. He talked about this at the end of his life, so we know it was a searing experience. And I think Davis understood the loneliness of the outsider. Secondly, when Davis went off to West Point, he came under the spell of a charismatic officer who was a teacher there named Alfred Mordecai, a North Carolinian, by the way, who was the first of the great soldier engineers who understood ordnances and was revered at West Point and ultimately had a glorious career in the U.S. Army, was sent to Europe to look at the Crimean War and wrote a book that the U.S. Senate printed up 20,000 copies of and laid the basis for the reforms in the American Army to come. He looked at weapons, he looked at organization, that sort of person. And I think Davis said if it was good enough for the U.S. Army to promote a man regardless of his faith, that it was good enough for him, so that when Benjamin came into the cabinet as Attorney General, he kept him on in 3 different jobs despite enormous controversy. Even in today's time, modern presidents would have let a man go who had drawn that kind of controversy.
Oh, he had some vitriolic attackers.
That's right. He had some bitter people who daily attacked him. I couldn't believe the nature and the anti-Semitism involved in the attacks on Benjamin and on Jews in particular. But I read through the daily accounts of the Richmond papers, and it is extraordinary to read this barrage and parade of charges. But my insight here, I think, is that Benjamin served Davis in the same way the Sephardic Jews had served the kings of Europe for hundreds of years. He was the kind of court Jew of the Confederacy, and it was the fact that he was Jewish, could not aspire to further office, that allowed Benjamin, that allowed Davis to trust him in the way that he did. Secondly, he was a lawyer, he was used to serving clients, and he had a kind of indefatigable way about him. He worked 12 to 14 hours a day with Davis, and wrote 2,500 memos that we have in the war. Not to mention speeches that he said he drafted, which were Davis's speeches. And at one time even told someone that I could never write a book about this war. I was Jefferson Davis for part of the war.
And yet Jefferson Davis mentions him, what, two, three times?
Twice in a 1,500-page
biography. Is that anti-Semitism? What is it? What's going on there?
No, I think it's complicated, Wayne. I think in that sense, Dave, I worked in the White House for a while as a speechwriter in the Lyndon Johnson period. I mentioned that as another reason that I think that I was the right biographer for Benjamin, in the sense that I think I understood the aide's role. Presidents, and Jefferson Davis was a proud one, think of all of the staff who works for them as sort of extensions of themselves.
So there's no need that's
right.
to do that.
And secondly, Benjamin had said in a letter to him, I do not want to go over these controversies again. This was a book written really to make money 20 years after the war was over, this two-volume work that Davis... There are certain haunting qualities to the question of why he didn't mention Benjamin. There may have been other reasons. He had written many people to ask for their advice on a number of matters and had gotten back the cold shoulder from lots of them who didn't want to be mentioned in Davis's biography.
Right.
We forget how passionate and controversial a war this was. And he wrote a rather scathing attack on people in the beginning of his book. This is Davis saying, those people that that run from the truth, I have nothing to say about them.
Is it fair to say, Eli Evans, that Judah P. Benjamin made any difference to the outcome of the Civil War? You have characterized him as part of a brain trust that surrounded the leadership of the Confederacy. Does that matter?
I think ultimately fate and God determined the outcome of this war, and in some ways there were pivotal moments in the war when things could have gone either way. Benjamin was indeed a kind of Kissinger-esque figure, and I think there's a great deal of the Nixon-Kissinger relationship in the Davis-Benjamin relationship. Here were two very isolated, very suspicious presidents under tremendous stress and strain. Here was a brilliant Jewish Secretary of State in both cases operating on the world scene. And Benjamin's activities really were abroad, and also to take care of the foreign press. He ran the spy mechanisms abroad, and that's another story that we should get into, because I think it has to do with the reason that Benjamin and Davis ended up somewhat strained in their relationship.
Well, let's pause on that. Are we talking about, a 19th century version of the CIA, of the FBI?
Yes, Benjamin ran the spy network as part of his role as Secretary of State all over the world. That was part of his function, and his major strategy was to try to draw Britain and France into the war.
This also got him accused of, part of the assassination
plot? He got him accused of complicity in the assassination.
Lincoln.
It's an extraordinary story, and really I'm sort of the first person to see it and to write about it in that way. I had never really looked at the post-assassination literature before, but this was a bitter, terrifying time in American history. We almost lost the Constitution. We almost lost our country. It's been called the Age of Hate by some historians, and rightly so. Benjamin had launched a spy network in Canada to try to foment troubles on the Canadian border. And he was aided in that sense by Seward, who was the Secretary of State to the Union.
And who became his enemy.
Right, and who proclaimed the purchase of Alaska, which was called Seward's Folly,
right.
And the manifest destiny of America to extend across the North American continent. So Benjamin's job was to take Seward's words and to see discord and suspicion in Canada. And he sent a spy network under there, a Mississippi senator named Jacob Thompson. Well, as luck would have it, this spy network brushed against John Wilkes Booth in the course of Booth's career. And once the assassination occurred, within hours, Stanton, who was then Secretary of War and a more difficult, ambitious ruthless man has not existed in American politics, immediately proclaimed that the South was to blame for the assassination of Lincoln and called for the arrest of the spies in Canada for the arrest of Jefferson Davis. A call went up for a number of others to be arrested, Robert E. Lee and others, and Benjamin was in that group. Now we are in an instance of great mythology in American history. Abraham Lincoln was the first of the first president, really, of the age of photography. His picture was in every household. He was revered and hated. You could find him in little shacks across the South from black slaves who had been freed by him. The passions were unleashed immediately upon his death, which occurred, incidentally, on what has been called Black Friday of what has been called Black Easter.
Right.
There were 2,500 sermons preached that Sunday, comparing Lincoln to a kind of fallen Christ figure. The papers were filled with cartoons of him going to heaven on the wings of George Washington and Christ-like figures.
And all of this made it very easy to assign blame.
That's right.
And that's how Benjamin
and actually Judah P. John Wilkes Booth was called the American Judas. And so this figure, this immediately martyred, almost theologically martyred president, there became to be act out a kind of Southern Confederate passion play, mm-hmm. in which I'm sure Judah P. Benjamin suddenly felt threatened. And we don't really know the answer to this because it has to be derived from almost the literature surrounding it, because so much of the trail has been burned and destroyed, not only by Benjamin but by others. But there is interesting a dime novel now that was written that portrayed Benjamin plotting with Booth. There were articles that appeared in the newspaper saying, with a letter to Judah P. Benjamin, with a kind of forged letter from John Wilkes Booth, clearly forged because it was dated after Wilkes Booth was killed.
Oh my goodness!
But it was a letter to Benjamin saying, "I did the job. Where's the money?"
Yeah,
that kind of thing. So I think Benjamin felt very threatened. I think that's the only thing that could account for the extraordinary silence that followed his trip, his going to England. I mean, here was a man who needed power, who needed publicity, who was, incidentally, he was one of the five great orators in American history, so called by experts on this matter. To read his speeches is really extraordinary, even today. They were flowery, of course, but that was the spirit of the times. But he was the voice of the South in the U.S. Senate. That was really how his fame grew. His speeches, however, were not of the tub-thumping, fire-eating variety. They were extremely intellectual. People talked about the timbre of his voice and so forth. So here was a man who really, really was silent after the war. And I submit that the only thing that could have done that was this great fear of retribution after the war. We know that Jefferson Davis, while he was in prison, received many threatening letters. Everyone knew where Judah Benjamin was. He was in England. He was practicing law. He knew Gladstone. He knew Tennyson.
He didn't make any secret
Disraeli.
Of that.
He didn't make any secret of that. Mm-hmm. He was a Queen's Counsel, practicing in the House of Lords in wigs and robes. There were articles about him in this country. It's not beyond imagination to think that threatening letters could have reached him as well, and particularly as this passion play played out in America.
Eli Evans, tell me about this man's, not his personal life necessarily, but the social circumstances surrounding him. He had a very difficult marriage. He had a difficult time with his, one daughter? Was that
yes,
right?
Yes, I think it starts really with the fact of the tremendous poverty that Benjamin was born into. While he had aristocratic roots, they were impoverished aristocrats, maybe the worst kind. That is, that they couldn't acknowledge that they were as poor as they were.
Here was a man who wanted to take care of his family made it very plain that he was proud to do that.
That's right, and he was very determined to do it. He was a brilliant young boy. He must have been hated by his classmates because there are stories of him studying and reciting Shakespeare at playgrounds while mm-hmm. other kids were playing.
And yet what happened to him at Yale?
He was thrown out or left?
What happened there?
Picked up by a very wealthy man who recognized his remarkable abilities and said that he had to be sent to the best school in America. And he went to Yale from Charleston, sent by this wealthy man. Then he left after he was first in his class. He was a brilliant debater and speaker there at the age of 14, if you can imagine such a thing, studying law and outranking people from the first families who came to Yale. He was caught up. He was one of the first Jews at Yale, incidentally, and that was another reason, I suppose, that I was a good biographer. I, too, left Chapel Hill and went to Yale to law school. And while I came 100 years after Benjamin, there's certain truths about Yale and its attitudes, residues, really, that are there and that one can feel and one can sense being Jewish and Southern there. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure all that came to play. He left school under very suspicious circumstances. And later, after he became Attorney General of the Confederacy, an article was written about him in the Abolitionist Press, which accused him of stealing from his fellow classmates. And this left a kind of cloud over his life. He never answered those charges. But he did return to Charleston. He wrote a letter asking to be readmitted. It's hard to believe that he would have written to be readmitted if there were moral reasons, mm-hmm, for his departure.
What about his marriage? Tell me about that.
Well, he went to New Orleans, and his marriage was a strategic marriage, if I can put it that way. He married into the upper reaches of the Catholic and Creole hierarchy there, the ruling class.
Did he become, in effect, a Catholic for the sake of
the people that surrounded him?
He
did not convert. That's an interesting thing about Benjamin. He never denied his Jewishness. He wasn't a practicing Jew.
He didn't speak it loudly,
it. But he used it. He used it in his speeches. There's a particularly wonderful example on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He was attacked by Ben Wade as calling him an Israelite with Egyptian principles, mm-hmm, on the floor of the Senate. And his answer is really pure Benjamin. It's a wonderful answer. "It is true that I am a Jew," he said, "and when my ancestors were receiving their Ten Commandments from the immediate hand of deity amidst the thunderings and lightnings of Mount Sinai, the ancestors of my opponent were herding swine in the forests of Great Britain." That's pure Benjamin. Uh-huh. And I think in the sense he did quote from the Old Testament, he did use his little log cabin Jewish roots, his roots into these great people, often in his speeches. So this was not a man who ran from it. But you ask me about his wife. She was quite a dashing, beautiful young woman. She had constant affairs with all kinds of people. We know that from the diaries of the time. And
a constantly, very, very cruel woman.
Constantly humiliated him. Mm-hmm. Finally left in 1845 and went to France with their only daughter.
And lived the rest of her life there.
Right. And so for 40 years, they did not really live together till the end of their lives. There's only one letter surviving from Natalie Benjamin. It's a fragment of a letter, and it says only, "Speak not to me of economy. It is so fatiguing."
Yes.
He sent her money, but never enough.
Eli Evans, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We're talking about your biography of Judah P. Benjamin, the Jewish Confederate. Why is he important today? Is he important today?
Well, I think he's important as context. You know, most of the Jews who came to America came in the 1880s. My grandfather was among them on both sides of my family. That was the enormous wave of East European Jewry. And most people think of Jewish history in America as beginning in the 1880s with the arrival of these immigrants. But that was not the America that the immigrants arrived into. There was, between Chaim Solomon, who financed the American Revolution in, mm-hmm, 1776, and Louis Brandeis, who broke through as a great lawyer and member of the Supreme Court himself, there was another figure in the 19th century, and that man was Judah P. Benjamin, who laid the groundwork, I think, for other minorities and laid the groundwork for all that was to come as part of the great American story, the opening of each new wave of immigration to the inner sources of power in America.
So even though he has a mixed history politically and socially, you would call this man a success, I take it?
Well, I don't want to use the word success or failure. Let me just say that this is a man to be reckoned with, a man, uh-huh, to be acknowledged. And I think I am proudest of the fact that the hardback is into 5 printings and the paperback has just come out, as you know. I really feel, in the letters I'm getting, I never got fan mail before, but Civil War buffs are that way.
Right.
What I'm beginning to feel is that I at least have taken a step in restoring this man to a central place in the American story.
Quick footnote to our conversation, Eli Evans. We have 3 microphones here. Let's suppose that Judah Benjamin is sitting in another. Very quickly, what would you ask him?
You know, Willie Morris asked me the same question, Wayne, and I said then, and I think I would say now, tell me, why did you burn your papers? That's really what I'd like to know. The second thing I'd like to know is I'd like to ask him about what it was like to be a Jew in the whirlwind, in the eye of the hurricane, and the torment and intensity and passion of the Civil War. What was it like not only to be a Jew who felt himself having been accepted into Southern society, but all of a sudden became the prototypical Jew who was going to be attacked all during the war? It must have been very difficult for him. You know, he walked around all the time with a smile on his face, mm-hmm. and he was called...
An enigmatic smile,
and everyone who knew him wrote about this. But my answer to that is, what else was he to do? Anger would not have mattered. Lashing back would not have mattered. I think this was his kind of mask, a mask of pleasantness, his kind of revenge, that he would rise above these attacks and do his job and stay at the millstone and hope that history would record it differently than the press was recording it at that time. I'd like to ask him about that.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Eli Evans, president of the Charles Revson Foundation. Eli Evans is the author of Judah P. Benjamin, The Jewish Confederate, published in paperback last September by the Free Press. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 479. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the ethics and politics of animal vivisection. My guests will be Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University and Nicholas Rupke of the Australian National University. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor two enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the world's first heart transplant, performed by Dr. Christian Barnard in 1967. Early December 1933 marked the repeal of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution, ending America's prohibition against liquor. Many churches this week will observe St. Nicholas Day, in honor of the 4th century Christian bishop, said to have inspired the modern figure of Santa Claus. Early December birthdays include Martin Van Buren, the 8th American president and the first born an American citizen in 1782. Willa Cather, the American author, born in 1873. Diego Rivera, the Mexican artist whose murals led to political controversy, born in early December 1886. Joel Chandler Harris, the creator of the Uncle Remus stories, born in 1848. And Ira Gershwin, the American lyricist and author, born during the first week in December 1896. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Jewish Confederate. This week on Soundings, Eli Evans discusses his biography, Judah P. Benjamin, the Jewish Confederate. Judah Benjamin was a pioneer, the first Jew elected to the U.S. Senate, Confederate cabinet officer, international attorney. The Jewish Confederate, the life and times of Judah P. Benjamin, this week on Soundings.